This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
The world is changing and changing fast. On Radical with Amol Rajan, I explore the deep global trends that are shaping and reshaping our lives. And I search for radical ideas for the future with people at the forefront of everything from global politics to artificial intelligence.
The internet's going through a massive transition, and I think that transition is inevitable.
Radical with Amol Rajan. Listen on the BBC app or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You step inside and you and I get briefed together on the big issues by people who know what they're talking about. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks to those of you who recently reviewed us, including Young Patsy and Robert JW12. This week, we're delving into the detail of the Mueller indictment, the 37-page document issued by the US Department of Justice, which accuses 13 named Russians of interfering with the presidential election in 2016. If you enjoy this, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. Just type BBC Briefing Room into your favourite search engine. And last week, we looked at the jihadis returning from Syria. Anyway, for now, take your seat in The Briefing Room.
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is.
Donald Trump last August on the Russian interference question, which, despite such defiance, has sprung to new life in the shape of an indictment of 13 named individuals. They're accused of being part of a grand conspiracy to defraud the United States for the purpose, and I quote, of interfering with the US political and electoral processes, including the presidential election of 2016. The indictment is the work of the special counsel Robert Mueller. So what's in it? Why has it been issued now? And what does it portend? Step into the briefing room to find out. First, the document itself. It's 37 pages long and full of intriguing detail. Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera has been reading it.
This 37-page indictment is by far the most detailed account we've seen about how one Russian organisation is alleged to have interfered in the US election. It provides a wealth of detail that we've never really seen before about their online activity, but also their attempt to manipulate people in America to carry out certain acts. Now, the organisation, as it's referred to here, is the Internet Research Agency, which was set up in 2013. And as early as 2014, it's alleged that it started a plan to interfere with the US election. The key allegation in the indictment is that this was a group of people setting up organisations, Facebook pages and the like, posing as Americans and not revealing that, in fact, they were Russians. Now, in terms of what they were actually doing, the central part of this is really attempts to manipulate the political process, sometimes by supporting or opposing certain candidates, but also sometimes by playing on certain divisive issues.
Defendants and their co-conspirators also created thematic group pages on social media sites, particularly on the social media platforms Facebook and Instagram. Organization-controlled pages addressed a range of issues, including immigration, with group names including Secured Borders, the Black Lives Matter movement, with group names including Blacktivist, religion, with group names including United Muslims of America and Army of Jesus, and certain geographic regions within the United States, with group names including South United and Heart of Texas. By 2016, the size of many organization-controlled groups had grown to hundreds of thousands of online followers.
The allegation is that this campaign started in 2014 with the creation of a department, which was sometimes referred to as the Translator Project within the Internet Research Agency. By about July 2016, there were more than 80 employees assigned to that project. You do get a sense, though, that what they were doing over time changed. The constant, though, really, is the attacks on Hillary Clinton, as well as, in some cases, some of the other candidates.
By 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators used their fictitious online personas to interfere with the 2016 US presidential election. They engaged in operations primarily intended to communicate derogatory information about Hillary Clinton, to denigrate other candidates such as Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, and to support Bernie Sanders and then-candidate Donald Trump.
One of the things that the Internet Research Agency did was create false persona for some of the Russians involved in it, it's alleged. It looks like they actually also did quite a bit of research reconnaissance with two members of the organisation having actually gone round a number of states in America in 2014 to try and understand the American political culture and potentially how to influence it. And they then start contacting and communicating with real people on the ground, sometimes people involved in the campaigns, including the Trump campaign, who were unwitting that these were Russians, and other people who were organising rallies and pushing them to do certain things. So to take one example...
In or around late June 2016, defendants and their co-conspirators used the Facebook group United Muslims of America to promote a rally called Support Hillary, Save American Muslims, held on July 9, 2016 in the District of Columbia. Defendants and their co-conspirators recruited a real U.S. person to hold a sign depicting Clinton and a quote attributed to her stating, "I think Sharia law will be a powerful new direction of freedom."
Then again, in August 2016, it's alleged that defendants used false US personas to ask real US persons to participate in the Florida Goes Trump rallies. And they actually asked people to do specific tasks at these rallies.
For example, defendants and their co-conspirators asked one US person to build a cage on a flatbed truck and another US person to wear a costume portraying Clinton in a prison uniform. Defendants and their co-conspirators paid these individuals to complete the requests.
So you get a real sense there of trying to organise events, rallies, push people to go to them and push people who didn't necessarily know they were being manipulated by Russians to do very specific things. You also get a sense of some of the tactics which are playing on divisions in America, particularly, I think, racial divisions. So here in another part of the indictment, on or about October 16th, 2016, defenders used the Internet Research Agency-controlled Instagram account called Woke Blacks to post the following message.
A particular hype and hatred for Trump is misleading the people and forcing blacks to vote Hillary. We cannot resort to the lesser of two devils. Then we'd surely be better off without voting at all.
So the implication of that message is basically trying to encourage blacks not to vote at all. So trying to suppress the non-white vote, which traditionally would have been seen very heavily going towards Hillary Clinton. But then, interestingly, after the election of Donald Trump in November 2016, you then actually get some political rallies in support of President Trump being organised, President-elect Trump, and others protesting the results of the election. One of the things that the indictment tells us, which we hadn't really seen anywhere before, is also the sense that those alleged to have been involved may have actually tried to cover their tracks. So at one point, we actually get the communications being quoted of one of those who is alleged to have been involved, Irina Kavazina.
On or about September 13, 2017, Kavazina wrote in an email to a family member, "We had a slight crisis here at work. The FBI busted our activity, not a joke. So I got preoccupied with covering tracks together with the colleagues." Kavazina further wrote, "I created all these pictures and posts, and the Americans believed that it was written by their people."
I think what you get from that email is almost the sense of fun that some of those involved had in creating these false identities. And that sense in which they almost saw it as a game is there in another really interesting story in the indictment, in which it appears they used a social media account to arrange for a real American to stand in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. and hold a sign that read, "Happy 55th birthday, dear boss." And this was just a couple of days before the real birthday, the 55th birthday, of the man who ran the Internet Research Agency. So it looks like it was some kind of present for him.
Gordon Carrera. So that's what it says. But what does it mean? My next visitor to the briefing room, down the line from Washington, is Molly McHugh, an expert in information warfare who specialises in US-Russia relations. She now runs her own group, New Media Frontier. Molly McHugh, how does the indictment change our understanding of what Russia's been up to?
I think the Mueller indictment was really interesting because it's being viewed as sort of a legal document, but it's actually a really interesting intelligence document. And I think it really exposes a new kind of intelligence operation that is being run by the Kremlin using proxies that is very modern and very digital and really focuses on the idea of online influence as a tool of power projection in a way that I think is very interesting. And I think that the real difference in some of what was described in the indictment was not paid or promoted content that was specifically political, but the idea of setting up false identities on social media backed by, in some cases, real documentation to verify their existence. That were running groups, individual accounts, other things, but meant to look like native content in American communities and within American society in order to influence the conversation in those groups. It's very much a description of a much more wholly formed operative structure being run from the Internet Research Agency that sounds a lot more like a modern digital illegal than it does like a kid sitting in a cubicle somewhere putting up content on Facebook.
A digital illegal. There's a new concept for us.
Mirroring the Soviet-era illegals concept of long-term deep cover spies meant to masquerade as Americans and others within the environments that they were embedded in. But the same concept of deniability, of having assets in place that are not yours, that are not quote-unquote Russian, but that are there as a line of effort that can be semi-independent seeming but controlled by state assets.
Is it possible to measure the impact of what the organization has done? I mean, one of the things that's said very easily is it won't have altered any election results. But some of the election results, from my memory, in some of the states was pretty close. So can we say that?
That is very much the $20 million question in what we are left with right now. But there are metrics we can look at. If you look at the activities that were outlined in the indictment, these were not just information campaigns. They did, in fact, get Americans to participate in rallies, events, protests, demonstrations, sometimes against one another. So it did change behavior, which meant people saw the content and it affected them in certain ways. I think in order to achieve that level of activation, there has to be a far greater level of perception underneath that. So people did see this content, whatever it was, and it probably influenced more people than or at least more people saw it than acted on it, which still has an impact on the environment. And sometimes the content seems very basic, but the themes on which we know the Russians were weighing in with their operations are ones where there were great amounts of debate in the U.S. election environment and pretty significant shifts in U.S. public opinion, specifically on the side of conservative opinion in the time period of 2015 and 2016 leading up to the election. Issues like trade, views of Russia and Putin, views of NATO, views of immigration, views of other of presidential powers and style of presidency, views of traditional and conservative values. On many of these things, you can look at broad national polls and see 20 to 40 point swings in public opinion. And so it's impossible to say that U.S. opinion didn't shift significantly in that time period. It is also then very hard to look at everything that was going on and separate out which piece of this was the Russian influence and which of this was American sentiment, far-right, alt-right sentiment. How were these interacting and playing off one another? But if you look at the broader landscape of the circus that was the 2016 election, the narratives Russia was promoting were integral to the debate and had an impact on how people made choices about the election.
Most of the group's activity seems to have been anti-Clinton, right the way down to being pro almost anybody else but her. But it appears that at one point the Russians actually organised anti-Trump protests after the election. What do we read into that?
I think it was very much meant to continue this environment of political conflict and division, playing both on the side of Trump being the greatest president ever elected and Trump being totally illegitimate, but setting up these narratives against each other to fuel the conflict within American society. This is a long-term strategy that Russian intelligence has pursued in a variety of ways, but doing it this way, sort of via social media as the core influence tool, is definitely new.
Molly McHugh. The next question is, what do we know about this internet research agency alleged to have spent all this time and money on the US presidential election? Andrei Soshnikov works for the BBC in Moscow nowadays, but he used to work for a newspaper in St. Petersburg, where the internet research agency is based. This organisation that calls itself the Internet Research Agency, who actually are they?
The simplest way to explain it is to go to Wikipedia and type astroturfing. It's a special term used for disinformational campaigns like this. Your organization creates lots of people profiles on social networks, on Twitter, on forums, on blog platforms. You're trying to influence the public opinion via this fake person's identities. So the main goal, the main aim of this organization, main instrument, is astroturfing.
Okay, so you've got an organization set up to do this astroturfing, as you put it, just to create these false identities to try and influence people and so on. Who set up and who ran the Internet Research Agency?
We know the name of the supposed sponsor of the project. It's Yevgeny Prigozhin. He's a main businessman who provides catering to Kremlin, to Russian army. He also serves Russian army in different ways. We know that Yevgeny Prigozhin, he's Vladimir Putin's friend from 1990s.
He's a man who's a catering tycoon who has somehow got into the business of what you call astroturfing, a significant kind of internet manipulation. Why would he do that?
Nobody knows exactly why he does it. Because he's a famous restaurant manager in St. Petersburg, and people call him Putin's chef because Putin several times praised his food and his catering. And once journalists asked Putin's press secretary what's Putin's plans for the evening, and he told that he's going to spend the time with his favorite chef, which was a message to Russian society, definitely, that they are close to each other. But why this person with no internet experience, no IT experience at all, doing such a sophisticated project? Some people say that he's like a fake person, like one of many fake person his employees create, like a symbol. But I don't think so. I think he considers himself as a patriot, and he does what he have to do for his country.
Where is this agency? Can you tell us where it is and what it looks like?
Nowadays, they have several offices in St. Petersburg, one mentioned in the Mueller report, Savushkina Street 55. And now they reestablished in several business centers. So you won't mention that it's some kind of a secret organization. Regular security in the entrance, regular people work here. Some of them looks like a typical hipsters.
What were the people who were employed there doing on a daily basis?
Most of the people are students in St. Petersburg or former students. They are young people in their 20s or 30s. Salaries are not that high. Most of the names you see in the U.S. Justice Department report, they are not famous. They are not super skilled professionals. Just regular people hired from the streets. There were open vacancies all over the Russian internet. Everybody could participate in this disinformational campaign.
So it's actually not very secure, is it?
It's not very secure. During the days me and my colleagues were investigating it, it was quite easy to find information about it, especially when employees were doing selfies in the office with lots of faces, and you could see the information on their screens, like on a selfie, but on the screens behind them. It was quite fun to see that they were not aware about cybersecurity at all at this moment.
Now, if you take a job at a place like this, do you know what you're being asked to do? Do you know what it's going to consist of?
The most fun part is no, they didn't know what they had to do. Vacancies names were Internet Operator, which means nothing. And when you go to the interview, first thing they do, they interview you about your political position. And if you have zero political position at all, they will hire you.
Is it your understanding that they're still operational, that despite all the exposure, that they're still carrying on their work?
After every big exposure, they were becoming more and more stronger. After this exposure, I think they will continue their operation.
And is their security better now than it was? Are they taking more care to keep what they're doing a secret, or do they still not mind?
Nowadays, their security is on a much higher level. For instance, people there are not allowed to use their smartphones in the office. They have to use a regular old-style mobile telephones with buttons.
Andrei Sushnikov. And we should point out that Yevgeny Prigozhin denies interfering in the American election and any involvement with the Internet Research Agency. But what about the special counsel, Robert Mueller? What has the publication of the indictment told us about his investigation and where it might lead? My final guest in the briefing room this week is Asha Rangappa. She's a former FBI special agent who now teaches at Yale Law School in Connecticut in the US. Asha Rangappa, my first question is, how do Mueller and his people, how do they know this stuff?
Well, it's clear to me from reading the indictment that they have a variety of sources. It appears that they do have human sources that have reported to them kind of the inner workings of, for example, the Internet Research Agency, which is the so-called troll factory in St. Petersburg. The FBI and the NSA, which conducts signals intelligence, they can also monitor foreign targets electronically and pick up conversations there. And remember that he also has several people who have pleaded guilty to charges that are providing him with information. These include Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, George Papadopoulos, who was a foreign policy advisor on the campaign. And he's now has Rick Gates, who was Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager's colleague or assistant. So all of these are possible ways that Mueller could have gotten information.
Now, can you outline why this indictment matters?
This is an incredibly significant turning point in the investigation. I think it matters for a number of reasons. First and foremost, from a national security perspective, what this does is it shines sunlight on Russia's propaganda efforts. And we know that Russia was operating in the shadows, pushing advertisements to essentially exploit divisions that exist in American society. And having worked what are called perception management campaigns for the FBI. I was a former counterintelligence special agent. The way to neutralize these is to make them transparent. So that's the main thing, is to lay this out for the public, especially given that we have elections coming up. But there are a number of other things that it accomplished as well. It allows Mueller to basically lay out, almost in a public report-like fashion, what Russia did and how they attacked our democracy. It gives a warning to other people who might have helped Russia that he has lots of information and it might be in their interest to come forward. And importantly, I think it actually protects his own investigation. There had been rumblings that Trump was considering firing him or firing his boss, Rod Rosenstein. And I think given that this indictment essentially frames the investigation as a national security investigation, that is now harder for Trump to do.
Does that educational function, which you talk about it having, does that explain why some of it seems to be written like a John Grisham novel?
Yes. So this is what's called a speaking indictment. What that means is the indictment actually lays out more information than is necessary to substantiate the charges that it makes. And the reason that they've done that is because they're essentially using the indictment as a vehicle to speak to, in this case, the American public, to lay out every aspect from the money to the people to all of the different ways that this perception management campaign was carried out. Interestingly, speaking indictments can sometimes be challenged by defendants because they can be prejudicial to the jury, for example. But in this case, it's very unlikely that these individuals are ever going to be dragged into court. So Mueller actually had a lot of freedom to use the indictment as a vehicle like this without having to worry that it was going to end up harming his case in any way.
Now all this has been laid out, do you think that the U.S. electoral system, because obviously there was this attempt to compromise it, do you think it's better protected now than it was back in 2016?
No, in fact, I don't think there's been anything done with the electoral system. And I think you bring up a good point. This indictment only highlights one aspect of Russia's active measures. However, we know that there were voting machines in 36 states that were compromised. We know that the Democratic National Committee server was hacked and that those emails were given to WikiLeaks and released and also offered to the Trump campaign. So there are other aspects of this that we haven't even seen yet show up in an indictment. And I think perhaps that if those aspects end up being fully investigated and charged in the same way that this was, then we might see actual actions taken to protect our voting systems.
Now, one of the things it says in the indictment is that there were some links with unwitting representatives of the Trump campaign. And this has been taken to mean by some people those senior figures in the Trump campaign. Is that your understanding of what it meant?
That is not my understanding of what it meant. Those unwitting members were in reference to local grassroots organizers on behalf of the Trump campaign. We know that these Russian illegals posed as Americans and basically co-opted people to do things on their behalf. This is how spies work. They will identify people that they think are vulnerable and easy to manipulate, and they will use them. This does not preclude the possibility that there may have also been witting members of the campaign who participated either in this or, as I mentioned before, in other kinds of activities that Russia was engaged in at the same time.
What's the impact of this been, Asha Rangappa? Has it been to shock Americans, or have they said, well, we kind of knew this all already?
I don't think it should come as a shock, because this is something that we have been hearing about for many months now, both from the intelligence community, which issued a unanimous assessment in January of 2017, back to September when Facebook admitted that there had been ads purchased on its site by Russian account holders. I think what this indictment does, though, is bring it together in black and white, in a narrative that everybody sees the big picture. And because it's coming through a formal legal document, something that has been filed in a court of law, it makes it much harder now to suggest that this is a hoax or made up or something that wasn't real or wasn't a big deal.
Finally, if you had to guess whether or not this indictment would be the last such indictment from the Mueller investigation, what would be your guess?
It is definitely not the last indictment. As I mentioned before, Mueller already has several people who have pleaded guilty and who are helping him. So that's one thing. The second thing is we know that he has collected evidence that don't necessarily fit with this social media issue. You know, presumably he's looking at other kinds of crimes and maybe nothing will come of it, but he's pursuing other investigative leads. So I think that there is still more to come in this investigation, and this is not the end of the story.
Asha Rangappa. And so to sum up, welcome to the world of astroturfing and digital illegals, and also to the knowledge that the Russian investigation is on track and that there's almost certainly more to come. My thanks to Gordon Carrera, Molly McHugh, Andrei Soshnikov and Asha Rangappa. We'll be back at the end of March, a year to the day from when Britain will be leaving the EU. We'll bring you a special programme looking at the future politics of the EU after Brexit. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Siobhan O'Connell. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And we really do like hearing from you.
The world is changing, and changing fast.
On Radical with Amol Rajan, I explore the deep global trends that are shaping and reshaping our lives. And I search for radical ideas for the future with people at the forefront of everything from global politics to artificial intelligence.
The internet's going through a massive transition. And I think that transition is inevitable.
Radical with Amol Rajan. Listen on the BBC app or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.